Hi folks, this is Chris again, not Mark, with another little disclaimer. As you'll hear on this show, there are a couple of gaps in our knowledge. We tried to make contact with the band before recording because they're not the easiest group of guys to find things out about. Unfortunately, even though they got back to us, it was just a little bit too late. So, apologies for any missing info or errors. Maybe one day we'll get a chance to talk to the band directly. Enjoy the show.
Hey folks, it's the Unsung Podcast. I've still got a sore tongue.
Can you crinkle your tongue?
I was sore. It was really sore.
I can't believe you fell for that.
You bastard.
Whereabouts is it? The side or the top?
It's in his mouth.
Oh, did you chomp it?
Aye.
Oh man,
I was pissed and eating Mexican food. I
just, oh no man.
And I had some mezcal immediately afterwards, so that probably helped.
Fucking hell.
Actually, it's probably the reason why I get drunker quicker.
Cause maybe the reason you bit it.
I went into your bloodstream and just
immediately in, man.
You can put the worm through the hole.
Yeah. But the first time I've ever had mezcal, it just tastes like tequila.
I don't think they would agree with you on that. But
they would not agree with me on that.
It's a bit like the whole grindcore thing. It's like, if you're not used to it, then it just tastes like tequila. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Grindcore,
power violence. Yeah.
That's it.
It's because my pal Ian, he was on a cruise for his honeymoon and he just come back and he was like, "What?" One of the entertainment on the cruise, one of the events was Flavor Flav just turned up.
Amazing.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, and was doing, and just like did a performance. And then,
what?
So that was a sea day. And then they were sailing on the way to Dominican Republic. And then the next morning, ship's got to stop because there's been a medical evacuation on the fucking helicopter. And he's like, are these two things related? I don't know.
What? That's fucking madness.
Instead of they checked in on Flavor Flav.
I don't know, man. But he was like, this is weird as fuck. Like, the day after he's been, it's just a, like pure like a medical stop.
It's always food poisoning on any boats.
Aye, totally, man.
Food poisoning or COVID.
Yeah.
Or both, aye.
Right, you join us for part two of our Yacoubsy episode discussing the album Tans Grozny Tans. We finished off the last step. So just looking at a little bit of the band's politics, I mean, as we said, they are one of the best examples of a truly unsung thing that we've covered. You know, not just, you know, an unsung album amidst a better known catalogue, blah, 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 but a genuinely underground band. That band, I can't even fucking remember how I actually got into them. And as Joe pointed out, it's the kind of thing that you would have thought could easily, had they wanted to, get picked up by the likes of like Relapse or one of those kind of labels.
Totally.
They never have. We'll never know. We might know because the band messaged us. We just didn't get the message in time prior to this recording. But, you know, if that pans out, a bit like we did with Jan and the drum, we could maybe do a wee supplemental interview and get a little bit of actual first person feedback on them. But we've referred to their words as often as possible. There's a lot of stuff archived on their website that was really useful to that end. So we were listening to their opinions and they seem like a nice bunch of guys. They're political without being overbearing. They acknowledge a lot of the hypocrisies that happen in the left wing, of the music scene, and just I think the left wing in general. They came from a squat background. We talked about that just a little bit, and as I said, we are going to do a proper show about the squat scene, talking about the history of it, because it turned out something that we could actually do justice in the context of trying to talk about the band at the same time. So stay tuned for that. But there's a lot to really get into regarding this very obscure little band from Hamburg in Germany. But one of the most interesting things to get into is their catalogue, right? Because I actually really enjoy the evolution that happens across this catalogue, because it's quite distinct. So let's start looking through that a wee bit. Joe, just before we get into it, our friend Joe McGlynn is the third host this week. Joe, of Man Must Die, as he loves to be known, as well as Go Down Fighting, a hardcore band. And Joe, what pod stuff are you doing just now? You did at one point do a Queen podcast, but you've packed that in.
Aye, stopped doing that.
You completed Queen.
Completed Queen.
So did Freddie, unfortunately. Yeah,
unfortunately, aye. I just do the one with Scott, the Shit You May Not Have Seen. That's me, pretty much.
Shit You May Not Have Seen, basically the unsung podcast for movies. to some extent. To the extent that you wrote me into it.
Aye, exactly. You'll probably be due back soon for another Bobcat. Bobcat
goal tweet.
I've enjoyed both of them, man. They've both been magic.
So Joe's particular insider knowledge on some of the extreme genres and subgenres is going to be incredibly useful over this episode, I suspect.
Hope so.
The discography of Yacoupsy.
Even though you put it all on a drive, it was still fairly unwieldy, I'm not going to lie.
Don't say that, the band might be listening. I don't think this band give a fuck. No. I don't think they'll mind.
Chris did buy it all.
No, I definitely didn't buy all of it. I did buy some of it, but no, I'm not going through that much Google Translate to try and get all those obscure releases. I do have some of the ones that aren't actually releases though, but we'll get to that shortly. I mean, it's all fragmented. If you go on different sites, so Bandcamp's got this, Discogs has that, other things have listed X, Y, and Z that you can't get somewhere else. I've got stuff that I didn't see anybody mention, and I'm like, how the fuck did I get this? Because none of these sites have this one listed, so anyway.
I think, you know, there's certain kinds of punk bands that are underground of a certain age that just shit just happens and it just appears and it's just fucking everywhere, man. And you're like, what?
There's something so nice about that. See, as we go through here, there's like something so charming about the lack of fucks given about like records popping up right, left, and centre with no permissions granted. It's just like, ah, well, you know, fair enough, man. At least he's trying.
That's it.
So Discogs lists 12 albums, but of that I think half of them are splits. That's something that I realise that a lot of people, even the people that listen to this show, you know, as much as we think you're a discerning, sophisticated audience, you may not actually be that familiar with the idea of split albums, let alone split EPs. Mm-hmm. Like split albums in this, I mean, we are talking about a band that can do like 20 songs in 10 minutes,
37 songs in 21 minutes.
So
that's a long record, man.
Sometimes long record. They're like, to give people value for money, you have to team up with another band of a similar album. But yeah, so there's quite a lot of that with bands from different territories as well. You know, they'll maybe tour together or they'll just look to capitalise on each other's audience. So it makes sense, you know, when you're releasing on a low level and when you don't have huge publicity funds at your disposal. Yep. Sort of one of the ways to do that is say, right, this band has, I don't know, let's say 500 listeners. We've got 500 listeners. Let's put a record out together and then maybe both of us will end up with 750 listeners. You know, and that's kind of a nice approach that's worked really, really well, especially in the punk underground for years. Yep. You know, we've even got a sub-genre of show called the Split 7-inch, and that really comes from that idea of that you cross-pollinate audiences by getting different people to collaborate on shows and be therefore exposed. Even some of the bigger bands did it. I mean, Queens of Stone Age used to do quite a bit of it.
Aye.
Back in the day, I remember that's how I heard of the band Beaver.
Oh, man, I remember that.
Fucking Beaver lucked out in that one, didn't they?
Not half, aye.
Sure. But yeah, so EPs, splits and singles, we'll try and skim across these because there's a whole world of them. By the way, we should also point out the affordability of splits, because you're then breaking down the cost of a record. If you do a four-way split, you're basically getting all four bands to chip in, and so as a result,
that's cheaper.
It's cheaper. You're facing a less daunting amount to get over that hurdle of having a physical product. We already mentioned the logic of those splits. So they have at least, I think it's 22 singles, EPs and split EPs, at least 22 that I'm aware of. The first one they put out was actually a split with Noise Slaughter in 1992. I will say, Noise Slaughter's all one word, which can be Noise Slaughter or can be Noises Laughter.
Yeah.
I like Noises Laughter better, man.
I couldn't actually find that EP, which is disappointing, because on this show, I kind of pride myself on being able to track most things down eventually, but I maybe with a little bit more time I would have got it, but no, unfortunately.
As a gal, you're quite unhappy with a lot of their early recordings anyway, right? So,
well, yeah, let's not ruin it entirely. Crank Is Normal, 1994. Mark, as I gather it, you've got a wee bit to say about this.
No, it just sounds like it was recorded through a shoe.
I actually didn't think it was that bad, man.
I mean, it's
just shows you my fucking
level. It's got no bass at all, man. But
that's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah, but it sounds like it literally didn't have any bass though.
There was no bass.
Yeah. Like, I was listening to it thinking there's a frequency missing, and that's a weird thing to say about a record which is just like two frequencies. And it does. It feels like it's, when I say it, it feels like it was recorded through a shoe, because it's really fucking muffled because of the way it's recorded.
Oh, you held that thing I fucking sent you, man. Yeah. That was fucking hell.
Yeah, so it was, I mean, that's the only bit of comment I really would say. Oh, obviously, and a really weird cover of Boys Don't Cry.
I think it's not a bad cover, which actually is, I think it was alright.
They're really good musicians. Like
the boy's voice is pretty decent as well, I thought.
And that actually becomes more apparent as they go on as well. They are good musicians.
Oh, they're very, that's one thing that I also get into it. They're very, very good musicians.
But so, they're able to turn their hands to something like that that early in their career whilst making something that's almost atonal. I have to love that shit,
man. It's also like one of the first things they ever put out. But okay, so I can shed a bit of light on what you just mentioned, right? So, but I'll do that in the context of, they also did a split with Active Minds, with whom they'd been touring. That's another kind of power duo. What would you say? What kind of style, Joe?
Fuck, I don't know, man. They'll probably hunt me down if I get it wrong. I'll go for speedcore.
Safe. Yeah, a band they loved. The EP with Active Minds, quite a lot of tracks in it, is fucking ratty as fuck. I'm going to use the word ratty quite a lot because I think it really applies in this, right?
You can smell the squat, man.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of that EP is just sheer audio sandpaper, but the energy is totally wild on it. So Stoffel, when he was doing an interview with Short, Fast and Loud Zine, it was quite illuminating in what he said. So this is Stoffel speaking to them. Due to the lack of possibilities, we recorded our first demo tape, the first 7-inch EP, Crank Is Normal, and the split 7 EP with Active Minds in the same room of the Youth Centre where we played our very first show.
That would explain why it sounds like, right, it's recorded through a shoe.
That was the one that I think they played at a birthday party in that Youth Centre. Right?
That's fucking so brilliant, man.
He goes on, we had no real engineer. We just placed the social worker of the venue behind the mixing desk and kept it simple. I don't know if that means the janitor. I think it might have.
The guy that mops the floors, man, cleans the toilets.
Just make sure nothing goes red and you're fine.
Some microphones had been placed and all the stuff was recorded completely live, straight to the tape.
Love that.
And then he goes, okay, on both 7 EPs actually the vocals were done extra, but apart from that, during the first recording sessions we never used any overdubs or stuff like that, and actually that's still the way how we do our recordings nowadays. We play the basic tracks live, guitar, bass and drums. I add the second guitar and the vocals and that's all. It's no big deal. We like the spontaneous feeling and vibes in general, but I have to admit that 90% of our early recordings are really, really bad.
Brilliant.
He continues, I personally have no favourite releases of that time. I'm very self-critical about that, and sometimes I wish some of them would never have seen the light of day. I'm still satisfied with most of the stuff we did after our first 47 inches, but the early years, I don't know. It's not because the lyrics or the songs in general, it depends more on the bad sound, some of the artwork and the vocals. I don't think they're that terrible.
No,
but
I don't think
I don't know that bad.
But it is also clear that these guys are very capable, and as their time in a band goes on, you can hear the precision and the talent and the intricacy of some of what they do in the music. I know for a lot of people it just sounds like white noise, but there's a lot of savvy in what they do. And so him going back to those early things, it will be a little bit of a redneck. But let's be honest, who doesn't get a redneck from some of their earlier stuff?
Yeah, we've done a whole episode on it. So
Joe, is this a good point for me to cut in that demo that you sent me, your other band?
Lee mute the sample button at the start, man, because it's dodgy as fuck, but I fire it. Bearing in mind, this was like 28 years ago, man.
We'll need to get you to come back and do an episode on your first band.
Intros.
Yeah, on your first intros. Band. I'll do that. I'll get, in fact, the guy who sings in my hardcore band, The Now, my new one, he was a singer, so I'll get him as well.
He'll
be like,
good.
He bought it. Aye.
Goes be good. Around, comes around. So yeah, I mean, he's clearly not very pleased with some of that early stuff, and I get it. I mean, it's the kind of stuff you would pick up on a, you know, those 7 inches that wouldn't really be in printed sleeves. They'd just be these kind of wee thrown together paper things and a wee polythene jacket and stuff like
there
that.
There used to be a guy that worked, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. There used to be a guy, see when the very first Missing opened up, the very first one, there was a guy worked in there. We used to call him Neil the Punk. So if he's listening to this, shout out. It was a lot older than us, obviously. And it was him that put me onto all that. See, like, the Power Violence stuff. And I'm talking, like, fucking 93. And he was like, I was getting into buy, like, Sick of It All records. And he was like, oh, do you like that? Then he, like, got me that crossed out thing. And that was the same. Photocopied 7 inch, and it was another band called Battle of Disarm. There was another band called MVD, Pink Flamingos, and that was all really extreme. There was a lot of Japanese hardcore.
Pink Flamingos get a mention a few times by Jacobs.
Aye. And he was really feeding us a lot of that. Do you know what I mean? So I totally remember that time and when those were flying about, because I bought a few of them.
So it's a sound that I'm quite forgiving of, because it really is just very honest. It's just like people with no money just trying to get something on record and have something to sell at the shows to keep the fuel in the tank of the van.
Actually, and I'm not trying to be a pretentious cunt here, but I actually kind of prefer it.
Yeah.
Aye, I prefer it. I almost like the demo sound. Like, you know, as long as you can still have a demo sound and it still has the essence, it'll still sound good. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Case in point, that crossed out thing. I don't know if you checked that out.
I did.
I mean, it sounds like they literally just put a fucking microphone in the middle of the floor and played, but it still sounds good to me anyway. Do you know what I mean? So I don't have a problem with that.
Yeah, I have to say, like, I've had records in my life that were just surprisingly good for repeat listens, even though they were obviously just these one mic, two mic recordings, four track gangs.
All those like Agnostic Front's first, like Victim in Pain, even like the really, really early like Minor Threat stuff, you know, like the singles that they did. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't sound good, but the energy's there. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, I mean, if they were produced better, they wouldn't have the same impact.
See, in saying that though, I love it when your Copsy start to get more hi-fi.
I do agree with that though.
Power is,
it's fucking amazing. Definitely.
So just to quickly run off some of the other EPs they did one in 96 with Vaseline, one in 96 with Inner Conflict. Joe, stop me if you know any of these names. One in 99 with Bizarre X. One in 2000 with Tumult. One in 2000 with Rot. One in 2003 with Sanity's Dawn. One in 2004 with Fuck on the Beach, which is
I've heard of them.
Yeah, Japanese kind of thrashcore power violence trio. They did one quite recently, 2015, with Shit Noise Bastards. Absolutely.
A quality name.
A great name for a band, yeah.
Oh my, I went and checked these guys out. Unbelievably fucking brutal Malaysian noisecore band.
Aye.
They've got an album called Raw Noisy Blast, and honestly, it's something else. It makes fucking Lightning Bolt sound sleepy. It is just absolutely fucking rabid. They've got a split album with a band called Irate Architect from 2016, who, by the way, I actually sent them on to
aye.
Because I kind of think it's got that more metally edge to it. It's quite sort of techy, like technical.
Kinda, aye. The chops are there, eh?
And I thought they were fucking watertight, that band. it's not a sound I would spend a lot of time with, but really knew what they were doing.
Oh, aye, totally.
And then we get into the albums or the LPs. So 1991, winding back to post that initial sort of release, demo number one, 21 tracks. Initially, it was a self-release, but it's since been repressed numerous times by various imprints. Some of the tracks in it, we've kind of touched on them already. You got that intro, you got Boys Don't Cry, you got the 11th track in it, Hellbound. It's a cover of Satanic Malfunction. Who are a band from Scarborough, actually, in England, from the 80s, and Jacobsy name-dropped them quite a lot as being a big influence and a personal favourite. Satanic Malfunction actually made a comeback in 2013, released some new stuff. The 12th track, Frizz, has some clean pick guitar in it. Track called Jello Biafra, which is this momentary like one bar of ultra fast punk noise. It's a bit like Dead by Napalm.
Aye.
They got one called Zeitvertreib. The drumming and that one is already really, really tight, I think, compared to other young punk groups. And that sense of, we would call it, uncompromising extremism is already starting to push through. I think for so early on in the band's career, it's quite an interesting telltale sign. They finished that with a track called Ice Bar, which is a cover of a really fucking good German band called Grauzone. It's like a kind of post-punk classic, kind of. It's maybe like Cold Wave Krautrock or something like that. I've got the album down there, the Grauzone one. It's really, really good. The next few years was kind of occupied mainly by a lot of those split EPs and singles that I rhymed off earlier. In 1998, which is a good 7 years later, they put out their next sort of individual full-lenther called Fuck Punk Rock. This is Turbo Speed Violence. It's a whole shitload darker and heavier than that first full demo.
Yeah.
I think frenetic probably a good word to describe it.
Definitely.
Emu is on drums. The band also now has a bassist, Frank. Stoffel, talking to Short, Fast and Loud zine, said, we met Kula, who's the owner of Rudel Records, at one of our first out-of-town shows somewhere around Berlin. Back in Hamburg, we soon entered the aforementioned youth centre with some borrowed equipment and started to re-record most of the material from that first demo tape. We added some new and unreleased tracks and did the whole session, 23 tracks in total, within one day. Again, in the unprofessional way, without any overdubs, sloppily played and a huge pressure of time. We finished the recordings with the vocals, and they're the main reason why I still hate this record so much. The youth centre was actually going to close its doors soon, and there was just 1 hour left to end it all. So I did the vocals with 1 hour under real pressure.
Wow.
In a crampy way. I don't know what that means. And I had no opportunities
in a cupboard.
And I had no opportunities to change anything afterwards. Personally, I'm still satisfied with the roughness and the spontaneity of the record, the songs in general, and even with the lyrics, but the vocals and the bad sound are responsible. Therefore, I really dislike this shitty piece of plastic.
Mm-hmm. It does sound a bit more muffled than the later stuff, I would say. But there's bass on it, which is nice.
We'll be right back. Yeah, there is.
Yep. It's got a song called Blind, which is melodic.
I've seen that one on other compilations,
which is completely, it's like almost post-punk. It's really quite charming, actually. I liked Lear. It was like a slow metal song. Matador is basically what they become. Mm-hmm. It's basically the band they fully become later on. Memories of Tomorrow is a hardcore punk song.
Is that the Suicidal song? Memories of Tomorrow?
Yeah.
You do mention listening to Suicidal Tendencies and some of
their first record, probably. Yeah. Aye, because that's just fucking punk. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. There's no metal on that.
So there's a little bit of a confusing release alert thing for the next one, right? Because in 2001, they released an album, and excuse my German here, Einstweilig Vernichtung, which I think was then re-released as Vorlaufig Vernichtung. Now, maybe if the band do hear this, they can help clear this up. I'm sorry, guys. It's sometimes quite difficult to understand what happened when and, and how, because both of those titles translate to something very similar, which I think is like preliminary annihilation or temporary destruction. I'm sorry, I don't speak German, and so I know the translation's not perfect, but they're both very similar translations. They both got the same songs, but in different order. So it seems that Einstweilig Vernichtung is 37 songs, it's just over 20 minutes. Vorläufig Vernichtung is 39 songs, and it was in the original order that the band wanted. Now, that was re-released in 2023. The original one came out on Slap a Ham Records.
All right.
You know that poster of the apes evolving into man with the spear and all that shit, and then in the end he's carrying a suitcase? And the modern kind of copsy equivalent of that poster, evolution poster, I think you can really see the music taking shape. You know, you can see the posture changing, but at this point it's still very much covered in like matted fur, if not spikes. It's still very fucking rough. The record, all of it has this air of like saturated tape heads.
Yeah.
You know, the bass is fuzzy to the point of speaker failure in some cases. I mean, I love it.
I like it, yeah.
But it occupies a much crustier space. The reissue is the same recording with two songs that are not in the original, so I'm guessing they might have been cut by the label. It's also got the original cover art, which is a decapitated corpse, which is kind of unsane-ish, kind of pretty grim stuff. Musically, the album itself is fucking feral, but it's also kind of goofy in places. So for example, the 12th track in it called Apocalypse ends with a whistling solo.
I love that. I thought that song was tremendous, man. Like,
it's a good song, but who's got the fucking ending coming?
I know. It's also got a really weird sort of, the guitar's like a beat down, but the drummer does like a whole jazz thing, and you're like, this is really bizarre, why are you doing this? And then it ends in whistling and you're like, what the fuck?
they have a couple of weird choices in, across all their kind of catalogue with wee bits and songs. You're like, that's a bit fucking odd, that.
Yeah,
I like that a bit, but
light-hearted, it lightens the mood a bit.
Totally, I was going to say that they don't take themselves too seriously, which is cool.
The 20th track, Iltifatlar, there's a pure hellishness to that tune. It it's a weirdly innovative approach as well. It's not just straight punk, but there is something like strangely obscene in the way that it's played. Like, it's not like chords. There's just a real violence to the arrangement in that song that I found really compelling. And the 25th song in it, Fleisch, which I think makes
Fleisch is good.
Yeah, it makes an appearance on a few different releases. That sounds like a turbo version of Entombed. But it's got these really thrashy chops in it.
Aye,
it's like, I've said here, it's like basically a hardcore punk song with snippets of power violence. It's actually quite a fun song. It's got a lot of tasty guitars, I think. Uh-huh. There's a lot of thrash vibes in this record.
Yeah. Well, that's, I mean, I think that one, Fleisch, has got a lot of that in it.
Faustrek is really cool. It's got a very Slayer riff, but it's a bit more frantic and chaotic. Nyx has got a really fun structure. I liked it because it's like at one point in the song, just out of nowhere, there's this pure hi-fi guitar solo for 3 seconds and then it vanishes. And then it goes into a massive beatdown at the end. And I was like, well, this is totally everything that I enjoy about heavy music. Nihilist is brilliant. It's just got a great D beat in it. Yeah. And I love a fucking D beat.
Everything's better with a D beat.
Yeah. The last song, Slap a Ham Pogo.
All one word.
Yeah, it's so good. It's a hardcore punk song with gang vocals, and it's got a weird sung vocal harmony at the end.
Yeah, I know. It's really good, isn't it?
Yeah.
So Slap a Ham is a label from San Francisco, so this actually got a US release, and it was started and owned by Chris Dodge of the bands Infest and Spaz.
Infest, aye. Yep, aye. Spaz, aye.
They released some really great stuff. So other bands that have been on that label: Melvins, Melt Banana, Discordance Axis, Man is a Bastard, Infest, obviously, Burning With, and weirdly, No Use for a Name and Fu Manchu.
What No Use for a Name record is, do you know?
I don't know. But
I can see No Use for a Name, but they know Sign Fat.
Yeah, they eventually got on Fat.
Go and, if you look at the Slap a Ham Wikipedia, it's got their discography, No Use for a Name and Fu Manchu are on there.
Fu Manchu, fucking hell, I've not heard that name for
totally
a long time.
In Congress. By the way, they'll be appearing on a show. I really like Fu Manchu.
I don't really know that much about them, if I'm brutally honest.
No Use as well. I love No Use. They don't have a consistent album, in
but
my view.
That means that a Slap a Ham alumni ended up in Foo Fighters, didn't it?
Aye.
Yes, that's true.
That's right, because the guitar player that plays with them now was in them, wasn't he?
Fucking yeah, weird.
I fucking hate these cunts.
See, it was Tony Sly actually told me audition for Foo Fighters, and he went and did it, and then he got the job.
I bet Grohl probably thought it'll add some sort of coolness to his shitey corporate band, man.
Probably. That's why he got the boy for Wool, anyway. Anyway, 2007. A record is out there in the ether called Fast Choreography, which is actually a fucking really good collection if you like this band. It's brutal. It's semi-comprehensive. Fucking excellent summation of their music up to this point. But it's quite a funny genesis, right? So Stoffel described this in an interview. Fast Choreography was a funny accident. One fine day, by the way, have you noticed he likes that phrase? One fine day. One fine day, a guy from Peru dropped me a line to get a kind of permission to release some of her stuff.
Oh, I see.
Because it's hard to get any of her stuff over there. I agreed to send him a bunch of her songs based on the fact that he would hand it around as a tape or a CD. Later, he requested some artwork and lyrics, etc. I sent him the lyric stuff and told him to create his own artwork because of my lack of time. A while later, he wrote to tell me that the CD is on its way to its pressing plant, and that's what I call youthful enthusiasm. Haha, no doubt that guy was really cool and we'd appreciate his support a lot, but if I'd known before that this project would turn into a real CD, I'd have changed everything in advance, different running order, the tracks, liner notes, etc. So that was basically just some wee gadget. It was like, can I get a tape to give to my pals of your record?
And then put it out.
Then they actually released it. It's
like that's class, but
that's what I mean about the total don't give a fuck, anything goes. Aye. Fucking absolute cowboys, the lot of them, eh?
If any other band did that, I'd be loiled up the fucking ass, man. Exactly, man.
So then you've got Tans Grozny Tans, 2007. That's the next non-split studio album. We'll come back to that. Speaking in early 2008 to Oxfanzine, after Tans Grozny Tans, Stoffel had said, the current LP was almost too varied for our standards. We decided to leave out everything superfluous from the upcoming tracks and go more in the direction of our Einstweilig Vernichtung record. The new album will definitely be a bit faster and more hectic.
I mean, he's right.
Right, but when you hear Tans Grozny Tans, hearing somebody go, "Ah, it's too varied, we need to get faster and more hectic."
I see, when I went back and listened to Tans Grozny Tans after knowing that, I was like, this is actually quite varied.
Well, see, the thing is, I just want to be clear.
That's weird, I've got a different.
Well,
a different...
their next own record, Timmy Wirgo Sum, is definitely not faster, right?
It's not faster.
But they did release stuff in the interim that arguably could be said to be faster and more frenetic, but we'll talk about that shortly, right? So I'm not 100% on the detailed chronology here, but the next two releases could hardly be more distinct. The first one is Pop Punk Alienation, 2008. When he was asked about this before the release, Emu had said, "Yep, it's recorded and quite funny. We wanted to see if we can cover pop punk bands, and I think we made it quite okay." Yeah. And we made two songs of our own, which have no or senseless lyrics this time. And I think, again, that's kind of a nice insight into this band. Like, they're not pure po-faced as well.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
So this is literally, you know, Pop Punk Alienation. Yeah, I mean, covers of mainly melodic punk stuff, including four Weezer covers.
Four Weezer covers. I fucking love Weezer, man. Like two of them are B-sides for the Blue album as well.
That's right, they're obscure ones. Yeah.
That's the only B-side album I know.
But see, if you're going to make a compilation album of pop punk covers, most people would be like, right, we'll do one song by this one, and they're like, no,
we'll do four songs.
Two songs.
And I like the fact they call it punk, was it Pop Punk Alienation, because it's like they're going to alienate all their fans by putting this out.
So what to me was even more ridiculous is that track one in this is So Much for the Afterglow by Everclear.
They are fucking rotten as well.
Even better than that is the fact that they didn't bother re-recording the whole Beach Boys intro to that song. They just fucking nicked it straight from the Everclear album, and then they come charging in with their own version of the main part of the song. Again, no fucks given for legal action.
It's brilliant.
The third track in it, Mall Monarchy, is a cover of Compulsion.
Yes.
Jan O'Kelma's band.
That's
from
the connection.
The
I was going to see if you'd known.
Jan, if you're listening, you've made a fucking surprise appearance in this episode. Jan is the drummer in The Drum, who we also interviewed in quite some depth after we did The Drum episode. Jan was an original member of the Irish band Compulsion, the kind of alternative punk band.
I didn't realise until I'd heard Compulsion before, but I didn't fully appreciate the fact that Jack Knife Lee was a singer in that band, and he's a big American producer, massive American producer now. He actually later went on to work on a Weezer record with Weezer.
Did he do a Queens of the Stone Age album as well?
I don't know, but he's done a lot of records. He's done, like, he's a massive, massive,
I know
massive
the name,
owner.
I know the name.
So
U2, done a lot of U2 as well.
Fucking hell, wow. U2, jeez.
Frame of reference here, that cover captures that lower registered UK alternative punk thing very well, maybe a bit like Therapy or something.
Yep.
The fourth track, Sliver by Nirvana, and I think it's actually a nice reminder that Nirvana were a punk band, really. They dropped me off at Grand Pajot. I kicked and screamed, said please, oh no. Grandma, take me home. Grandma, take me home. Grandma, take me home. certainly early on
when it started.
The basis at the time though, which is totally bizarre.
Well, I'll throw a span on the works there, man. Very metal as well, man. Like Bleach is fucking covered in metal riffs, man.
Aye, absolutely. The fifth track, Glorious Day by Weezer. Now, this is from the Green Album, Joe, you've just said you don't know.
No, I don't really know that record.
It's debatably their best album. It's fucking excellent.
That song is brilliant, yeah.
The sixth track, Beyond the Grace of God, is one of their own. And it's a nice wee insight because it's them taking the opportunity to write a pop punk song. Which is kind of adorable. It's like,
I like that.
It's cool. Even got oohs and ahs and stuff in it. It's just a chance to be something completely different for a day. On its own terms, I think the record's more amusing than it is essential. But in the bigger picture of the band, I really love what it does and what it says. And it isn't outright stupid. Like, it's genuinely, it's fun.
They've took the time to actually do the covers well.
Yeah, there's no piss taking in it.
No.
I think it simultaneously sets them apart from countless other uber earnest bands of their normal genre, who are maybe too wrapped up in their own misanthropy to crack a smile. Not these guys, you know.
Aye, totally.
And in the same year, they released a split album. We'll give this a mention because it's with Rescue State and La Vendetta, who are both Colombian bands. We're talking about how they actually did quite a lot in Colombia. The record's called In Memoriam, and all the bands on it are actually pretty good. They released the Gastzimmer, which is translates as guest room EP. It's 32 tracks written with all guest vocalists, and it's split roughly half and half, like side, male and female. It's written specially for it. All the tracks are relatively short. The vocalists were asked to write their own lyrics and their vocal part. It includes people for a lot of the bands that were already mentioned throughout the course of the show, and it includes Chris Dodge. He actually sings for it as well. I like the first side actually, and hearing the non-male voices is pretty refreshing, but the tracks on the first side are incredibly similar. There's a lot more variety on the male side.
Aye.
On the first side, the 14th track is called Individualitat, and it's by the vocals are by Sabina of the band Holy Moses. It stands out just due to the pitching of her vocal. I think it's great. The 17th track, Bandsteigkart, is Danny, D-A-N-Y, of the band Dead. That features a male and female vocal overlap, and it actually sounds a bit like a fucking demented version of the B-52s. It's pretty cool.
Nothing wrong with that, man.
The 19th track, Der Hautigam, is a guy called Klaus of the band Razors. That stands out because it's got a really good gang vocal in it, but the only thing is it ends with these whimpers that really reminded me of Jonathan Davis.
Oh, no. That's not what you want.
First Corn album's all right, man. Come on. At the time I'm talking about when it came out, man.
A lot of water under that bridge, though.
All the water's under that bridge.
The 26th track in that, Vastoon, is Julio of a band called Cripple Bastards. I And
oh, Cripple Bastards, aye.
Right, cool. Yeah. So he sounds like a mad foreign version of Jello Biafra, but it kind of works. I think the similarity of the backing tunes and that, as I said, the band wrote the music and left the singers to do it, and so I'm sure everybody was given a sort of fair shake, which is why the tracks all sound vaguely quite similar. And that gets a bit wearing, but it does sound like everybody on it had a fun time, so...
That's all that matters.
Yeah, it's kind of nice. Then we get to 2019. Joe, I know you're going to have a bit to say about this, because they released the album Timeo Ergo Sum. Now, I think, was this a self-release? Is this the best self-release we've ever mentioned on this show? Because this is an incredibly high quality album.
Well, I was going to say, this is, for me, out of everything I've heard, this is my favourite thing that they put out.
Yeah, I mean, even though I'm obviously going to make the case for Tans Grozny Tans, that's not a self-release so much as it's been helped by all these different labels. This just said self-release. It's fucking brilliant.
Aye, like, production really, value is fucking... Production, yeah. I mean, it sounds like... They've got that CD that you mentioned earlier about the Entombed guitar tone. This especially
the
is
HM,
like
pure HM2
heavy metal. The Metal Zone pedal just dimed up to fuck. But it's brilliant, man. And it sounds like Kurt Ballou's production.
That's what I was going to say. It sounds like Nails or something. Like it's like sonically like almost like identical to that those kind of records.
Aye.
And that's
like Trap Them and all that type of shit.
Yeah,
that sound. Aye, you know, fucking, like, it sounds amazing.
It's a total rager. It's our most recent full studio album. I mean, 28 years into this band, and this record is absolutely fleeing, you know. They're still very much not pleased.
The thing I like about this album is as well, it's got fucking weight.
Yeah,
a lot. It's got a lot of weight.
It does.
But it doesn't muddy up the sound.
Let's use the word heft.
Heft,
I like that word.
It's got tatties.
So again, the modern recording techniques continue to really complement them. There's something much riffier to this record, I think.
Aye, there's more metal in this.
Definitely.
I also think as well, the clarity kind of helps the riffs that are there be a bit more apparent and defined.
Probably that's intentional as well. We've discernible riffs here. We need the production to basically fucking put it forward. Do you know what I mean?
In terms of some of the tracks I'd pull out of that to comment on, the third track, Kopfless, has an amazing riff and breakdown in it. The fifth track, Weltreich, despite this really caustic start, it has a filthy, doomy ending.
It's so nasty. That bit.
The eighth track, Nyman's Land. Again, another brilliant riff at the end of that one.
It's quite choppy at the start, then it slows down and it gets quite bouncy.
It's the ending for me in that one, though, that really turns the head. The tenth one, Nat.
I've got that as well.
NEH/T. DB Extreme Hardcore.
Huge beatdown. It eats the walls, man.
Real Venom, massive. And then that massive beatdown.
But a real beatdown. Yeah. No, just chugging on a fucking open chord.
Yeah, no, totally.
It's fucking fierce.
Proper beatdown,
The 12th one. Durchgestrichen. So this
I've
is
got that one as well.
Yeah, so this is interesting because it's a filthy, slower animal, and you know what? It really sounds a lot like DeSalvo's best work as well.
Yeah,
Glasgow band.
I sent it on to Phil because I know Phil really likes this band now. I was raving on at him about them, and I think he's away out and bought one of their vinyls by mail order as well. But that track in particular reminds me of DeSalvo. It's also the pitching of the throaty vocal was really reminiscent of P6. The 21st track in it, F22.0.
I've got that one as well, fuck's sake.
There you go. It's a bit of an outlier in that the first half of the song's almost post-punk, but then it really explodes.
Some proper metal riffs, that song.
And then the other one that jumps out is the title track, 24.
I've got that as well.
Temuo Ergo Sum. Just doom, doom, doom.
That sounds like Trap Them, sounds like Black Breath, sounds like All Pigs Must Die, sonically,
yeah,
musically. I loved it. It's just so malicious.
Yeah.
It's malicious.
Did you pick out any songs I didn't mention? Or the
first song, Misanthrop, is it the first song?
That's right.
Yeah. The bass just sounds huge on it.
Yeah,
like, it does, absolutely,
yeah,
massive. Das Wilgen Zum Tots is just some really
nice one.
It's got some bell in it. Like staccato bit,
they
like,
love that
like
wee
a bell, which
bell,
I really, really like.
There's some comedy bell in this. I mean, you might as well use it to get my cowbell.
Aye, man, totally.
Yeah, and Kate Lynch. Which has got so many blast beats, but then has got quite a big metal ending as well.
Yeah. I wish I knew about this album because I would have fucking took actual notes of the songs, man. I just loved the whole fucking record.
It's a good record.
It's a good record.
A really
loved
good
it.
Record.
Aye, brilliant.
A couple other odds and ends that I want to mention before we talk about Tans Grozny Tans. So there's a bunch of stuff that's unofficial, and this is in keeping with their like don't give a fuck kind of approach. I spotted a split tape with DRI from 1998, but I'm not sure if it's actually official because it's only got two DRI tracks in it, but 20 Yukovsky tracks on it.
DRI. 98?
Aye.
I don't know, man. That sounds as if they've just took two songs that they like for DRI and put it on a language.
It could well be, man. Yeah. I think they're live as well, the DRI songs.
I don't even know if DRI were still even fucking putting out records in 98.
We should probably mention their very unofficial 2003 split EP titled Yukovsky Deep Weezer, which was released by a company in New Zealand and has one track by Yukovsky, one track by a band called Deep, and one track by Weezer.
Fucking brilliant. So they actually took the Weezer track. Amazing, man.
It's one of the four for Pop Punk Alienation. It's a B-side for the Blue Album.
Is it Mylene Carly?
Yeah,
or is it
that one. That one, that's the third.
What happened to Weezer, man? I mean, they're really shite now.
A lot happened to Weezer.
They're really, really shite. I mean, I was never a massive fan, but I did like
certain
stuff.
They should have stopped.
Fucking rotten, man.
We did a double episode on them, man. Trust me, I've done my time.
And they've released more Erica records since then, which I have listened to. They released four records in 2022.
We're not doing
they don't
that.
Put a lot of Van Halen.
That's actually a fairly decent record.
Is that all right?
It's actually fairly decent.
All right, okay.
Let's not go there, right?
There's one thing I do need to say about Weezer.
No, you don't.
Right at the pandemic, they released a record called OK Human, which is all orchestral.
I heard that.
And it's fucking so good, man.
That is actually all right, because so I did good. Check that out. It was all right, aye.
It's the best thing they've done in about easy decade, and Rivers has written everything on it as well, pretty much.
Wow.
Just shows you, like, maybe if a lot of these bands kind of step to their kind of comfort zone, they probably write better records. It's when they try to stick to the what they used to sound like and try and...
Anyway, that Weezer thing's clearly not legit, but it's a fucking lol.
It's funny.
And the other one that jumped out to me, and this is probably my favourite release that they've got, and it's very much definitely not official, but it's a split EP with Napalm Death titled Ultra Thrash Noise Cranium Meltdown 1.
When was that?
2020.
That's bollocks. That's no official.
Listen,
man.
It was released on Bus Pop, which the logo is the Sub Pop logo with the sub turned round.
That's fucking brilliant.
Which I think
make shit up.
That might be their imprint. I'm not sure. Side A is Jacopsy's song Armed and Crank, and side B is Dead brackets fast version. The whole EP length 2 seconds.
The Napalm side,
so
brilliant.
Both tracks 1 second long. Fucking genius. And the only other thing that I saw was Screaming Under Hyperviolence, which is a cassette CDR only. Not sure when it's from, but it's like a fan collection of early stuff, split EP tracks. But it seems to have caught on a bit, because you saw it in Discogs with like a bunch of different photos and versions of it. So it seems to be something that's circulated amongst their crowd. And actually, like I said, I've got a couple of things that are collections that I didn't see listed on any of these. And I'm like, this must just be a fan compilation that's, aye, you know, like the equivalent of a playlist that was actually committed to tape or CDR. So yeah, brings us to Tans Grozny Tans. Now, we're not going to go through all the fucking songs here, because you've got 25 tracks. The record's 28 minutes long. We're just going to pull out our highlights here, so it will be mercifully brief. I do want to say Stoffel, talking in an interview, said Tans Grozny Tans is our cynical altercation about the war in Chechnya. Somehow I'm surprised that we apparently are the first band which is dealing with it. So yeah, this album is very much a Goldilocks point for me. It represents, I think, my favourite combination of factors. Those would be like the band approach, so three piece with bass, stylistically hedonistic, but it's got riffs on it. They're playing, which is excellent. The recording, which is ratty and acidic. It's a sharper sound than you get on Timmy Ergo Sum, but it's also still got a clarity that allows you to follow the music. And then the vocal delivery, which I think is exceptional on this record. The sound and the writing captures a precision that I think even that like Vernstung record was missing, partly I think due to the higher fidelity and partly due to like their improved use of sounds, like their actual instrumental sounds have improved. And I think the record actually has a blackened quality to it as a result of maybe a little bit of the vocals, because at times his pitching goes up a bit, but then the sheer speed and the saturation just gives it that sort of tremolo picked sort of like insane black metal thing. Some of the standout tracks that I'll pull up, I mean, feel free to shout out if we've got the same ones. Fourth track, Verbrant. Which I think is a great wee calling card with this really simple swing to the vocals in it. I love the fact that they also keep the coughs in the mix for the vocal takes.
Oh, that's right.
It's very David Yow, You guys want to pick one out?
Actually, I know we kind of said five, but I kind of picked out kind of like seven, but maybe we look at my notes here. I like track 13, Frost.
Yeah, I've Frost
got, I've got that as
that's
well.
One of the best here. It's actually got a verse, chorus, verse.
I said the dynamics in the clean, you know, pick section, and then it goes into that kind of chaotic burst. It just comes out, and then it comes back into the kind of picked, very much like reminding me of like Steve, really, really, no, really early Dillinger Escape Plan, but you know that dynamic they have where they'll go from really, really quiet to like a burst of fucking absolute noise, then go straight back out again.
But see the weight, so like the pick guitar gets like smashed apart by those explosions, and the weight of those bits is so intense.
And that's another interesting thing about this band as well, is see like a lot of production techniques, especially for bands of this ilk that play nowadays. Every time they do a lot of stop starting on a fucking dime, man, you know what I mean? It's quick. That just shows how good they are as musicians as well. They can fucking, and they're fucking on the ball. But see, every one of those cuts, they're clean. And I love that, because I fucking hate every single grind power violence band nowadays. Every time there's a gap, and they don't fall into that. They don't fall into that trend, and I like that. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, the guitar riff has like actual gravitas. It's got like, again, to use black metal, it's got like a black metal melodrama because of the chords that they choose in it.
I
Aye. And oh man, the outro is victorious.
Yeah, but then we have the tremolo picking and the second guitar at the intro, at the outro. It's pretty cool. It's 100% my shit. Mm. It's also got a D beat just before that, which I love. But see the clean sections, they sound exactly like Slayer, like in the terms of the chord choice and the notes that are used.
Do you notice as well that it sounds like, I mean, being a fucking geeky bastard here, but the actual, see the pick guitar bit, it sounds like the action on his guitar's no right. And I like that about it. It sounds too dull. Yeah. It sounds like there's not enough resonance when he's hitting the notes, as if they die out before they should. So I love that, because he's just obviously picked up some fucking ratty guitar.
It's almost like if you've got like really dirty strings or something.
That's what I was going to say. He's no changed his strings. He's been using the same fucking strings. But I like that about it.
One I'd mentioned, number six, Foulness. The opening growl, again, really blackened. And I think the ride cymbal breaks. You know, he does those single like
aye.
It's like got a nice kind of lightheartedness to it.
Aye, totally.
Yeah, I like the title track.
Aye, I've got that as well.
That's how you open a record, man. Like the vocal delivery,
the catchy, the vocal refrain hang.
It's very rabid sounding as well. I love the way that it switches between like the grind blast beats and then the more slower traditional kind of metal riffs. And then the D beat hardcore punk section is just at the end, sounds like Converge to me.
I like the two step button.
I got a translation of the lyrics to Tans Grozny Tans, the track's really interesting, because obviously this is about Chechnya, I'll talk about that in a minute. The lyrics at start go, "Black widows, hot rhythms, get involved, don't stand still, I want to see your body twitch, dance Grozny dance," and that's what Tans Grozny Tans translates that. It's quite a dark kind of humour, in a morbid kind of like gallows humour sort of way.
Aye.
"Hard cocks, wild dances, music in the blood, bullets in the stomach, don't be shy, put on your red nose, laugh Grozny laugh, oh lord, cheers to the merriment, blood and oil flow like a merry little stream, now get involved, don't stand still, to my child, I want to see you in poverty, Grozny ask to dance, look my love, don't worry, Moscow continues the topic, let's dance and play Korovod around the clock, it's women's election in Chechnya." It's pretty like, you know, it is poetic, going back to what they were saying about it. It's not
on the nose.
On the nose, exactly. The phrase I was going for there. It's not on the nose, but it's really conducive of a really uneasy feeling. Like there's a dark gallows quality to what they're saying there.
Kind of reminds you a wee bit of the guy for Pig Destroyer, especially the early Pig Destroyer lyrics, where they're like that, they're kind of pale, kind of like Trowel in the Yard. Well, quite kind of poetic.
I really like that. It's the kind of thing that it's so buried in the song. I mean, first of all, it's in fucking German, and secondly, there's no way you're making it out, even if you could speak German.
Aye.
But see, digging into it, the amount of thought and work that's been put into those lyrics
they're hidden in there. That just shows the integrity of them, but they're doing this for them. And that's it. They're not giving a fuck if it translates to anybody else. Do you know what I mean? I've got England, track 5. This is like old school Napalm Death, man. I know they don't really like to be labelled as the grind, but this is definitely got that kind of like, kind of Enslavement to Obliteration era, kind of Napalm sort of vibe. The bass tone's fucking stinking on it as well, man.
I remember that. Absolutely foul.
Man. I was like, fucking hell. You can really tell these guys can actually play and could probably play fucking anything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? These aren't just guys, they're no anal cunt, do you know what I mean? They're not just fucking smashing their guitars and making noise. They can actually play, because there's intricacies in this track that if you really, I guess you need to be attuned to listen to this type of music to really kind of, you know, be able to focus in on that. But aye, the guitar playing's tasty as fuck on it, and to play that fast and that tight, man, fair play.
And sing,
exactly. Yeah. Aye.
The eighth one, Profile Neurotica.
I've got that.
Yeah. has a real death and roll charge to it that then snaps into a blast beat.
It's also got
a really good vocal hook at the end. The breaks are pristine in it.
I've got that.
Did you notice as well, see at the end, it sounds like it's stopped and then there's a 1 second of like...
It's class, isn't it?
I've got a drama. It's got like that weird, horrible bass tone, then guitar, and it's like call and response at the start, and then it goes into just pure insane blast beats. It's like pure vicious as fuck. And then it gets even more vicious because you slow it right down.
Yeah.
And it's just got a really nice texture to it. Yeah. You know, it feels like it's just creeping up your back and it's going to throttle you.
So going back to the Entombed comparisons, Femme in a Bend.
I've got that one.
Also vocally, one of the strongest Blackened tracks.
I love the vocal cadence of this song.
Yeah, yeah, I think the vocals in this are brilliant. It's got a furious ending as well that caps it off really well.
Death metal riff.
Well, see the riff again. As a big fan of Entombed, the riffage on that one really reminds me.
There's a lot of Entombed in this, and the other album as well, the one after it.
Mm-hmm.
I've got track 20, Nebernorum. Is that it?
I just like that. That's like that. Aye.
This one's just fucking Brutal Truth, man. From start to finish, it just sounds like they've went, we're going to write a song like Brutal Truth.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a big early Brutal Truth fan, so that suits me. There's a lot of like single string drilling, you know, like that. And that's like obviously coming for like the kind of, you know, we spoke about this in the chat where it was like death metal influencing kind of like hardcore. And then like, you know, you get those kind of riffs that are in the context of the hardcore typical kind of Slayer riffs. So it's got a bit of that happening. And I like that about it as well, because it varies it up. It's not just always blocking chords. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I love the 12th track, Adenauer. It's a fucking vicious tune that's got a disgusting bass tone in it. I mean disgusting in a good way. With cymbal chokes over that bass tone at the start. That's great. It's also notable, I think, because it clearly utilises studio mutes.
It does. I mean, it's edited. Yeah, it's absolutely edited.
They don't do that in all of them, though. In some of them, you can hear there's like a gate kicks in, so it's actually performance. Aye. But on this one, there's a definite studio mute
on-off,
which is quite distinct for their early days. But it works in the context that...
Aye, it does, aye.
It gives it a sheen, though. Gives it a production sheen.
Yep.
I've got a...
you try to pronounce it?
Yeah. Drastilicate? Maybe that's what it is. I don't know. But it basically feels like a Madball, a Sick of It All song, but it's got twisted vocals in it, and it's got loads of blast beats in it, but the core of the song sounds like fucking Madball. I quite like that. Well,
Big Freddy Madball. Yeah.
We already spoke a little bit about Antagonismus.
I have got this as well, the harmonics
and the solo rim clicks. It almost sounds like it's going to be experimental. There's not a lot of tracks on this rival it for sheer venom when it gets going as well.
Ah, it's raging, man. Yeah. That bit you're talking about, where it does the harmonic and then it's the rim shot.
It's great.
That's class.
One of my favourites is the 19th track, Hertz. potentially the nastiest song in the whole record for me, tonally and in terms of that verse as well, which is just relentless. And then it gives way to this absolute monster death and roll kind of chorusy hook. That's a great tune for me.
I've got track 24, Stalk Peart. Fucking love the vocal cadence in that song, man.
Could you hear a little bit of Sepultura in this one?
Aye, totally. Aye. I've wrote that here as well. Aye, it's very metal. Do you know what I mean? It's almost got that old school Discharge vibe, where it kind of, I call them circular riffs, where they kind of go da 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 da. We could just go around. It's got one of those tighter riffs in it, yeah. And I love in general the singer in the band. A lot of these songs are catchy. With the probably to the average person, how the fuck can you say it's catchy? But his vocal patterns are really, really good.
Yeah.
And that's a very, very important thing when it comes to this type of music with me.
Yeah.
If you're going that fast and that aggressive, the singer becomes another rhythm. You're not necessarily, because there's no melody, but his vocal patterns are really, really, really smart.
Well, that's the secret to that fourth track that I mentioned, Verbrant, because it's the vocal rhythm has the swing.
Exactly,
music's straight, it's the vocal percussively.
Of course,
gives it the swing,
I mean, being a fucking, that's what I did in my band, that's number one. You don't have any melody, so it needs to be interesting vocal patterns music. You know?
I have Christ Lull Collapse. It's a very metal, reminds me of Conversion Places, and they bring in towards the end a second guitar, which sounds like something Kurt Blue would play as a lead part.
Yeah.
It's just a really nice sort of, again, different type of heavy. Like they kind of bring in loads of different parts for different genres of heavy metal. And
well,
heavy
remember
music
his criticism this? After this was that he said it was too varied. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think it's too varied. I think it's just nicely varied.
That's the thing. Like, see the album after that. What's it called?
Timmy Webb.
That one. I actually thought that, I didn't really see that much of a difference. I thought it was still catchy riffs in it and shit like that.
Same, yeah. Mm-hmm. The last one I would mention would be the 25th track, Vogelfrei, which is a big, lumbering, unhappy ender.
Oh, a saying song, innit?
Yeah.
Aye, that is good to
eye. Ends the album really well.
Yeah,
it does.
So, will I sum up my arguments here? So, I mean, for me, this is, I think this record is up there with like a Terrifier in terms of sheer extremity, as well as like enough moments of catchiness. I say catchiness in a qualified sense, and character to make it memorable without it also just being an endurance test. Because, I mean, with a lot of this kind of music, it's just an endurance test, right?
Aye.
Whereas albums like Terrifier, I think, had breakthrough because they had moments of like, it pulls you in, identifiable little, oh, there's that bit.
You need that in this type of music.
I think this record gets that fucking totally right. I know they feel that, oh, it's too varied. I don't agree. I think actually you've nailed the formula here, which is this sounds interesting for its entire runtime. It keeps it interesting, and it's amazing that I don't feel exhausted at the end of this record, despite how furious it is.
No.
Joe, funnily enough, you and I, so we went to the Napalm Death gig, right? And we watched them being supported by Pig Destroyer. And afterwards, we were talking about it. Less said about Primordial Man, the better. We were also saying the same thing, I think, about Pig Destroyer, right? So I'm watching Pig Destroyer, but I was craving Yacoupsy, because Pig Destroyer and me were weak. They were slow. They were a bit pedestrian.
I
was like,
dare I say, too metal.
I want some ferocity.
I think I said this to you as well. If I listen to this type of music, it needs to be relentless. Like, I don't like it to, I know the odd occasion where it slows down, fair enough, but I just want to have my fucking cunt smashed in when I listen to this type of music. I don't want like big, no disrespect to the beatdown, but I'm not interested in beatdowns, man. I just want to get fucking pummeled to death.
See, I think the likes of, like, Terrifier is a great record, and Prowler in the Yard is a good record as well, but because they get that ratio right
They get too metal after that for me.
After
Destroyer, they get too metal.
But I feel like this album totally rivals that. And I think the fact that this band are nowhere even close to Pig Destroyer's profile makes this, like, to be, frankly, an open and shut case for being unsung. I mean, the album, but the band in general, I think this is a fucking excellent band. And I think when I'm going to other bigger bands on world tours and I'm kind of, it's like you're sleeping with somebody but you're thinking it's someone else, I'm watching Pig Destroyer, I'm like, I can't wait to get home and listen to fucking your Popsy. You know,
no,
that fucking
that
says something, man. So I am really happy to be able to platform this, because I think a lot of the people listening to the show will love this band, and I would almost guarantee there was no other way they were going to hear that.
Oh, 100%, aye.
Yeah. That's a good record. I'm glad they spent time, albeit brief, with the discography. Yes, they were, dare I say, a fun band to listen to.
It was kind of fun. That's the thing. I thought totally. It'd be harder. I mean, I've listened to stuff that is far less intense, that has been a much, much tougher listen.
Yeah. Oh, 100%, man. Fucking right, aye. Right. Coldplay, in case in point.
Weezer.
No, fuck, I don't even put Weezer and Coldplay in the same sentence, man.
You have no idea how difficult that fucking Weezer album, the episode was.
Brutal,
see, once we got away from Maladra, man, fuck me, man, my life was over.
Yes, not exactly an embarrassment of riches.
Okay, well, fucking, I'm glad that went down quite well then. I think that only leaves the Nexus.
It does.
A complicated series of connections between different things.
Joe, did you do a Nexus?
I didn't, man. I thought that was your thing, man.
Oh, that's totally my thing. That's fine. Yeah, Mark, cool. Did you do an Nexus?
No. Is this like the fucking Kevin Bacon 7 degrees of separation?
So, for new listeners, or maybe...
I don't even know what it was.
The members of your
group. Did you link him to Brian May or something like that?
So, basically, once a week, we pick a name out of a hat as suggested by a listener. And we then have to try and connect the band or the artist to that name via a series of jumps, like six degrees of separation, Kevin Bacon, right? So last week we pulled the name Patti LaVine out of the tub as suggested by a long-term listener, Catalyze. It turns out Patti LaVine is a character from the TV series The Leftovers, played by famed character actor Ann Dowd. Mm. By the way, just a little aside here. The fuck is a character actor? Because I'm always saying that.
So I don't know what a fucking character
is. Surely they're all characters.
Is that
not
like somebody that doesn't get the big part?
That's exactly it, yeah. So it's not quite a supporting actor, but it's somebody that always plays important characters, but never quite
the main person.
Okay, so it's a wee bit patronising.
No, because there's actually a lot of actors who that's all they
specialize
want to do, and
that's
specialising in.
Well, Anne Dowd is one of those.
There's a few I can think of, like Margot Martindale. She's a really well-known character actor.
Who was the one that they animated for? Was it South Park or was it Family Guy? Did an episode where it was all about this one famous character actor? Anyway, that's a bit of trivia. Someone stick that in the comments.
If you know what it is,
okay, so I am going to connect Jacobsy to Patti LaVine from The Leftovers. And since the other guys aren't doing a Nexus, I am going to indulge myself. And I've got a feeling that the band, if they are listening, will approve of this, right? Because we're going to dig a wee bit into the second Chechen war, all right? Because remember we said that Yukopsi are not the most online of bands, okay? So that sometimes also means that this could be a little bit tricky to get off the boards here. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not that hard once you start trying to connect to popular TV characters, but it's fucking hard when you're trying to connect to a three guys from Hamburg who barely have a website and who you kind of get in touch with. So
that should be fun.
But I managed it, right? So as we know, Tans Grozny Tans is about Chechnya and the Second Chechen War. This is a really topical Nexus, and I hope everybody appreciates where this goes here, right? So it ran from 1999 till 2009, technically. There was a series of Russian apartment bombings in September of 1999, that are what make this topical. I'm going to just use the word here in air quotes, false flag, question mark. Okay, now false flag is a horrible term just because it's been appropriated by all kinds of nutty fucking conspiracists for everything from like 9/11 to COVID and the lot, right?
But they have, and they do happen.
It's a
legitimate counterintelligence and espionage thing to stage lots of things, you know?
So they absolutely do help. I think like the Gulf of Tonkin, the Americans' use of that in relation to Vietnam. That's a really famous example. But there's probably more examples that don't actually happen. Yes. However, I would suggest that the Russian apartment bombings are a very strong candidate, and here's why, right? So the bombings actually took place in three different cities over four different incidents. It was Bunyansk, Volgodonsk, and Moscow. And we often, people say the Moscow apartment bombings, but it wasn't just Moscow. Now, Putin's response to them cemented his popularity and actually nurtured the support that allowed him to conduct the assault in Chechnya.
Raised Grozny to the ground.
Thousands of people buried in their own homes. Scenes that were actually, sadly, very similar to what's both happening in Ukraine and what's happening in Gaza.
Syria as well.
Yeah, in Syria. So in July 1999, here's where we start. The Russian journalist Alexander Zhilin was writing in Moskovskaya Pravda, and he warned that there would be terrorist attacks in Moscow organised by the government, and it was using a leaked Kremlin document as evidence, and he said the motive would be to undermine the opponents of President Yeltsin at the time. That's in July of that year. Four blasts hit those three cities in September. Timers were set to go off at night to inflict the maximum number of civilian casualties. The explosives were placed to destroy the weakest parts of the buildings to force them to collapse. Chechen militants got blamed for the bombings, but they always denied responsibility, as did the president of Chechnya, his name Aslan Maskhadov. And this is where it gets really interesting. So on the 13th of September, this is where we're talking false flag stuff, right? This is why so many people are suspicious about these bombings. On the 13th of September, the Russian Duma speaker, Gennady Selezhnev, made an announcement in the Duma about having a report that another bombing had just happened in the city of Volgodonsk. And a bombing did happen in Volgodonsk 3 days later. Mm-hmm. So he announced that they just got this report. Oh, it hasn't. And then 3 days later, a bomb went off in Volgodonsk. So a guy called Zhirinovsky said to him in the Duma, remember, Gennady Nikolaevich, how you told us that an apartment block had been blown up 3 days prior to the blast. How should we interpret this? The State Duma knows that the apartment block was destroyed on Monday, and it has indeed been blown up on Thursday. Selezhnev, in response, turned off his microphone in the Duma and didn't answer, and later just said, oh, it was all just a misunderstanding. So also on September the 13th, that same day, 1999, a businessman called Achimez Gochiaev called the police and reported two bombs located in apartment blocks in Moscow. Gochiaev claimed that he was being framed by an old acquaintance who was an FSB officer, that's the Russian Secret Services, who had asked them to rent the basements as, quote, storage facilities. And so after the explosions elsewhere in the city, this guy Gochiaev realised that he was being set up, and so he called the police and reported these. They said what was going on in the basements. He got suspicious. And the next thing, so a device was found and defused in an apartment block in the city of Ryazan on the 22nd of September. This is about 9 days later. A resident in the building noticed two men carrying sacks into the basement out of a car, and he called the police, but by the time the police arrived, the car and the men were gone. The bomb disposal teams went down and worked through the night and found that a timer had been set for 5:30 in the morning, okay? On the 23rd of September, a telephone services employee in that city tapped into a suspicious phone call to Moscow and overheard the following instruction, quote, leave one at a time, there are patrols everywhere. And that number was traced to a telephone exchange serving the FSB. So a search began for this car, which was two men and a woman, and arrests were made. And when they were arrested, the detainees produced FSB identification cards, and Moscow promptly instructed that they should be allowed to go. They were set free. Now, the position of the Russian, this is the best bit, right? The position of the Russian authorities on the Ryazan incident changed a lot over time. Initially, it was declared by the FSB and the government to be a real bomb threat. And then after those people were caught and identified, the official version changed. Then they were like, no, no, it was just security training.
Fuck's sake.
Right? So on the 24th of September, the director, a guy called Patrushev, announced that it was an exercise that had been carried out to test responses to the earlier blasts, having already said that, no, no, this is a genuine terrorist incident. It turns out the police warrant officer who answered that original call and discovered the bomb insisted that there were no doubts it was a genuine, quote, combat situation. And in an interview, a guy called Yuri Kachenko, who was the explosives expert who defused the bomb, said the detonator was absolutely real and primed, and that the sacks contained explosives as confirmed by this testing device at the scene. And that was later refuted by the government.
Did those two guys fall out of windows at some point?
You would think so, yeah. Attempts at an investigation investigation or an independent investigation have always faced obstruction by the Russian government. I don't like conspiracy theories, generally speaking, but that doesn't mean that none of them have some validity to them, right? We shouldn't fall into that trap. And likewise, this doesn't mean that 9/11 was a conspiracy, which it was not, okay? But this case does absolutely stink. Why is it topical? Because, as you'll know from recently, the terrorist attack at Crocus City Music Hall, 22nd of March this year.
Trying to reverse engineer it as a false flag, which is fucking bananas.
Yeah, so that's, people started saying, oh, this is a false flag. Now, 144 people killed, I think it's 550 or more injured. Islamic State in Khorasan, which is Afghanistan kind of area, has claimed responsibility.
Numerous times.
Revenge for Syria. Yep, numerous times. They arrested these Tajiks who do seem to be the men in the video. But yet, when I spoke to Russian friends, they initially assumed, oh no, the FSB did this. This was our government doing this to ourselves to justify more conscription. And now you're kind of caught in the middle ground where it's like, oh no, maybe it was a genuine terrorist attack that the government just allowed to happen because it would be advantageous to them. To others, be like, no, that's nonsense because Putin looks weak, blah blah blah. The problem is, what is the fucking truth?
Oh, yeah.
You get to this point where
you just don't know.
You've had these situations that do seem very genuine, and now you're in a situation where it's like the boy that cried wolf.
No. Multiple intelligence agencies across the world, including Iran, told Russia what was going to happen.
Oh, absolutely. The Americans told them directly as well. Mm. But anyway, yeah, so that happened in Crocus City Music Hall. Back to the Nexus. I just wanted to highlight that because I think it's a teachable moment, right? And also cast a different light on the bombing of Chechnya, which was political utility for Putin, trying to establish this new regime, trying to, you know, stamp his authority on this new Russia that he was going to build, which brought us to today. Anyway, Crocus City Music Hall has been in the news here before. You might not actually remember why though. Okay, in 2013 it was the venue for the Miss Universe pageant attended by Donald Trump. A very famous pageant for a few reasons. It was thoroughly investigated afterwards because, first of all, there was a $20 million payment to get it to go there, but also they investigated Trump's conduct at the pageant and afterwards, because if you remember, he was alleged to have been filmed in a hotel following the pageant, getting a golden shower. And then the video was used by the Russian authorities to allegedly blackmail him during his election and presidency to encourage his, you know, positive disposition towards Russia and Putin and Russian interests. Now, there's no proof of that, but the debate continues. Funnily enough, Donald Trump, one of his lawyers during his second impeachment trial was a guy called Bruce Castor. Bruce Castor had a previous brush with infamy after he was the DA who refused to prosecute Bill Cosby in 2005, citing a lack of credible and admissible evidence. And in the mid-1990s, Bill Cosby had a one-season run of a whodunit crime show called The Cosby Mysteries. Mm-hmm. That series featured the actress Ann Dowd, who would later go on to play Patty Levin. And there you have your Nexus,
there
gentlemen.
You go, man.
That's good.
That's impressive, man.
A full fucking conspiratorial history lesson.
Nice, man.
Russian apartment bombings, you are welcome.
And almost Nazis as well.
Almost Nazis. Yeah, I mean, I could have shoehorned some in, I'm sure.
Everything comes back to Nazis, man.
It does in this show.
Aye, absolutely.
Yeah, it does in Putin's mind as well.
And Donald Trump's mind, just in a different way.
Okay, well, Joe, thanks so much for coming in.
Hey, bother, man.
Thank you.
Thanks for
it's
having me, man.
Mm-hmm. Go listen to Go Down Fighting.
Check it out.
Mama's Die. And
Acons, man.
And Shit You Might Not Have Seen.
Aye, listen to that as well, man. We've got a new video coming out for next June.
Good. Have any idea what we're going to do next week, Mark?
No idea.
No, we don't. So we'll leave that
something,
to chance.
Something quite chill.
Joe, would you do us a solid though? Would you reach into that little tub and pull out one of the bits of paper so we have a Nexus for next week? As promised, we will do an episode on squats and the squat scene in the reasonable near future. And we'll see if we can get in touch with Jacobsy as well. Mm. Joe, what does that say? Can you read it?
Fuck, here we go.
That's the big challenge.
David, fucking hell, man, it's all faded. It looks like David Vic Henry. Who wrote
this? David by Vicky Henry. That's our co-host, Vicky, suggesting we link to David, our co-host.
All right, okay, there you go.
It's finally happened. So we have to Nexus to Dave Weaver.
I think I've done it before, but we'll do it again.
Yeah, we should do it again. David's got a lot of good links. So that's the David Weaver, for example, cousins with the Your Ex bassist who then joined Cradle of Filth. There you go.
The Nexus is complete.
We get Nexus to Joe, no bother.
Aye. Can Nexus meet to Jacobsy as well, probably?
Yeah,
in fact, you most definitely can.
Via Russia?
Aye.
Via PT?
Via Nazis. Brilliant.
All right, thanks for coming on.
Thanks.
Man, thanks again.
You better go and shift that car before the traffic wardens get you.
Aye, because if I get fined, you cunts are paying it.
That is true. I did say that.
You sound like a Yacopsy tune from outside the window.
Yeah, fuck it, bastard.
Bye.
Bye.
See you later.